This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, political talk without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, a new episode of The Children's Hour with Amy Willens. Stories about Ivanka, Jared, Don Jr., and little Eric. Boy, are those kids in trouble this week. But first, the fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. It's been going on for a long time. Before Bernie and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there was Jesse Jackson in the 80s. Before Jesse, there was George McGovern in 1972. And before that, there was Henry Wallace in the 1940s. Of course, he was vice president to FDR in the New Deal era. Now that history is the subject of a wonderful new book. It's called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. The author is John Nichols. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. We reached him today at home in Madison. John, welcome back and congratulations on the new book. It's being published this week by Verso.
It is, and I'm delighted to talk to you about it, partially because it's a labor of love and partially because you're in it.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, but we talk a lot about how the Republican Party became the party of Donald Trump and how moderate Republicans disappeared. But the question you ask is, what about the Democrats? How did they become the party of the Clintons and Wall Street? How did progressive Democrats disappear? Where did they go? So return with us now to 1944, when FDR's Vice President Henry Wallace crisscrossed the country, warning of the danger of American fascism. You know, I was a little surprised by this because in 1944, the Democrats had been in power for 12 years with FDR as president. They had transformed the country with the New Deal. What was Henry Wallace talking about when he said there was a danger of American fascism?
Well, he was talking about something that was very, very different from European fascism, from what we were fighting against in World War II, at least in the physical form. He was not saying that the American fascist would be a Nazi per se, somebody that would dress up in a particular uniform or even engage in a particular language, but that authoritarianism was always a threat and that it was a very real threat in the United States, one that needed to be understood. And I guess the best way to say it is that what Wallace set out to do in the mid-1940s was to assure that World War II was a victory for the anti-fascist forces all over the world, fighting against Nazism and Italian fascism and authoritarianism, but also that the post-war period would address what he described as the roots of fascism, And that is a concentration of wealth and power. That is the manipulation of the media by economic and political elites. And that is the use of that manipulated media to divide the great mass of people, the common man, the common woman, against one another, rather than to have them focus on the deeper struggle for economic and social and racial justice. And so Wallace actually wrote an essay, which appeared pretty close to 76 years ago right now, in the New York Times, and it was titled The Danger of American Fascism. And the roots of this book, fascinatingly enough, are in Twitter. I have a few followers on Twitter, and I often tweet out quotes from the past, historical references, be it, you know, some great social democrat or a feminist or Shirley Chisholm or Ron Dellums, or a couple of years ago, I started tweeting from Wallace's essay on the danger of American fascism. And I was always struck that every time I would take a quote from it about how media was manipulated or how a divisive politics was advanced, massive numbers of people would respond. I mean, people were like, really? An American vice president in the 1940s said this? Huh. It seems so prescient. And so that was, in many ways, that was the root of the book. It led me to think two things. Number one, this is a subject worthy of exploration in this deeper sense, the sense that Wallace took us to. But B, it was very valuable to, A, reintroduce people to Henry Wallace with all of his flaws, with all of his weaknesses, but also with his strengths, and B, to see the rejection and the marginalization of Wallace as a lesson as regards how the Democratic Party frequently rejects and marginalizes its visionaries.
The key moment in the marginalization of Henry Wallace came when he was not nominated to return to the ticket as vice president in 1944. Why didn't FDR and the Democrats keep Henry Wallace on the ticket as vice president in 1944?
Franklin Roosevelt was not in great health. That's no secret. And that as he, you know, moved toward the end of his third term, many people did have questions about whether he had the physical strength to do a fourth term. He determined that he did, in large part because he wanted to win World War II. And he wrote a letter to the Democratic Convention in which he said, if I was a delegate to this convention, I would vote for Henry Wallace. But cool. He didn't expend immense energy to keep Wallace on the ticket because he was, frankly, afraid that the coalition might break apart to such an extent that he couldn't get reelected. And so he didn't put the pressure on that he had in 1940. So it fell to Wallace, and won't belabor all of it, but the interesting thing was Wallace knew he would have this fight. So he traveled across the United States at his own expense in the fall, or starting from the summer of 1943 into the summer of 1944. And in the book, I write about this remarkable journey that he was involved in. He went to Detroit, a city that had seen horrific race riots in the summer of 1943. And he spoke to a mass crowd of an integrated crowd of trade unionists. And he said at that rally, we've got to recognize something. We're fighting against people in Europe who divide humanity based on race, based on ethnicity, based on religion. And people in America who do the same thing are practicing an Americanized fascism. And so he identified racism and segregation as an Americanized fascism. this basically, he threw the gauntlet down, and he traveled across the country meeting with Jewish groups and Hispanic groups and African Americans and trade unionists and radicals, and said, look, you know, there's a fight going on here, and you have to understand it. This is the fight for what will come after World War II, when we come home from beating the Nazis, when we come home from beating the fascists. You know, what will we do at America, in America, to make sure that this divisiveness, this hate, doesn't infect our country, and that it doesn't take another form here? As you got toward the convention in the summer of 44, because of what Wallace had done, he had so delineated the differences within the party, the differences between those who were willing to compromise on segregation, those who were willing to compromise on sexism, because he was out talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, those who were willing to compromise on economic justice, and those who weren't willing to compromise, that the leaders of the party, beyond Roosevelt, essentially tried to exclude Wallace from the convention. Finally, an agreement was made that he could second Franklin Roosevelt's nomination. Just that. So Wallace arrived from Iowa. He was an Iowan, with his, you know, bag, carrying it himself, walked to his hotel, had no great organized, you know, effort on the floor of the convention. But he went to the podium on the third day of the convention and delivered a speech in which he said, didn't talk about himself at all, talked about Roosevelt, talked about what the Democratic Party had to be in the future. And he said, it has to be a party that goes straight down the line for racial justice. It has to be a party that recognizes that we have to operate in the world on the basis in the post-war era of diplomacy and trying to promote cooperation. It has to be a party that challenges the old orthodoxies and makes sure that we never go back to a Great Depression or to a rise of authoritarianism around the world. It was such an inspired speech that there was a groundswell at the convention to renominate him immediately. And it was so intense that the organizers of the convention, the party leadership, the big city bosses, the Southern segregationists, gaveled the convention out of order, shut it down, so that that could not happen. And the next day, they rearranged the tickets to the convention. They restructured all sorts of things. And frankly, they worked, as one historian described it, they worked through the night with, you know, every promise of ambassadorships and, you know, campaign money and everything else. And they thwarted this effort. And what I argue in the book was that was the beginning of a pattern of compromise, which we see to this day, where the Democratic Party has visionaries, has people who lay out the possibility of a transformational politics. But often elites, powerful figures within the party, manipulate the process in order to make sure that that vision does not become the defining force within the party.
Well, people who have heard of Henry Wallace know him as a failed third party candidate on the left in 1948. He left the Democratic Party and became the candidate of something called the Progressive Party, which historians all teach was supported by the Communist Party. People think of Wallace as a dupe of the communists, and in the end, he got only a little over 1 million votes, 2.4% of the total. Truman got 24 million votes in 1948. What's the truth about the Progressive Party of 1948, and how do you explain what a huge disaster it turned out to be?
Unfortunately, Roosevelt died, and Wallace wrote in his diary that as they took Roosevelt's body to Hyde Park for burial, you could feel the New Deal unraveling. And in those 1945, 1946, Wallace continued to serve with Truman for a time, but they fought each other. They wrestled with each other politically about foreign policy and including how to deal with the Soviet Union, whether to try for diplomacy and basically to try to win a battle of ideas rather than to militarize toward a Cold War. They wrestled over domestic issues as well. Eventually, Wallace was forced out of the administration, as were most of the original New Dealers. And Truman's administration became a much more centrist, you know, Democratic administration. This is not to beat up on Harry Truman in every way, but it's more to say that it just wasn't that visionary politics that really extended in a genuine sense from the New Deal. And so Wallace became very frustrated with this, but he was also a very popular figure. And so the decision was made to mount a third party campaign that was very much in the tradition of the Popular Front, pulling together kind of everybody on the left. And that did include the communists. It included socialists. It included, you know, radicals of all sorts of different traditions. It was a fascinating campaign because it did succeed in some senses. Biggest sense that it succeeded in was in seeking to break the color bar in the South. Wallace refused to campaign before segregated audiences. And so some of the first great integrated rallies in the South in this kind of post-war era and really a lot of underpinnings of struggle for racial justice, Wallace was a part of. He was backed by Paul Robeson and a young Harry Belafonte and many other figures. He was also backed by Albert Einstein and Frank Lloyd Wright. And you just kind of run down the list of people that supported him. And not all of those folks were hard on the left. Some were simply folks who really believed in Wallace. And so in some senses, at least in early stages of it, he did build out a popular front. But the campaign was poorly run, and it had a lot of flaws to it, and ultimately it was tremendously marginalized in the media by attacks from Truman and others and the Republicans, and so it didn't end well. And one of the things I wrestle with in the book is the great challenges that we put in front of third parties, how hard we make it to mount a third party campaign, and acknowledging mistakes that Wallace and others made, wrestle with that issue and the question of whether it might have made more sense for Wallace to stay within the Democratic Party and try to, you know, fight for the soul of the party within it rather than to go out. It is something that I do write a lot about in the book, and write a lot about a struggle. There was, interestingly enough, in 1947, group very strong in California called Democrats for Wallace, and they really tried to keep him within the party and get him to challenge Truman for the nomination.
Of course, this takes us straight to Bernie Sanders in 2016, a Democratic socialist who decides not to run as a third party candidate, but to run inside the Democratic Party for the Democratic nomination, the path that Henry Wallace did not take in 1948. That was an incredibly bold decision. Seems to us like it turned out to be the right one. Where does Bernie Sanders fit in 2016 in the history that you tell that begins with Henry Wallace in 1944? I know you have talked to Bernie Sanders about this very question.
Yeah, I have a little bit. And I've talked to him a lot about the New Deal and that New Deal era. Sanders, in 2013, 2014, when he was thinking about making his first presidential run, really struggled with the question of whether to run as an independent or as a Democrat. And I interviewed him for The Nation, where he actually, you know, kind of acknowledged the things he had to think about. He chose to run as a Democrat because of a couple of factors, that it is so hard to run as an independent or as a third party candidate, to create a third party. It's such a difficult thing to do that he chose to run as a Democrat because you then didn't have to go through all the battles to get ballot lines, petition signatures, structural creation of a party. You could kind of go deep into the debate. But, you know, the flip side of that is, as I think many Sanders backers will say today, is you do run up against the party infrastructure and against the more conservative forces in the party, the more corporate forces in the party. And it's a terrible battle, right? It's a great struggle. I go through this in the book all the way from the 40s to the 70s, or well, into the 70s looking at McGovern, the 80s looking at Jesse Jackson, and all sorts of other campaigns, things that Tom Hayden did with Campaign for Economic Democracy, and that Ron Dellums did, and Bella Abzug, and so many other people. What I ultimately conclude is that there have been successful progressive efforts within the party, and there have been successful efforts to move it forward. But there have also been really deep disappointments and a lot of frustration.
You write about visiting the farm in Iowa where Henry Wallace was born. I think you went there with Bernie Sanders just last summer.
I did. And Sanders was campaigning in that area. And so we were at the farm. And the farm, I just have to emphasize, Henry Wallace has been so written out of our history that the farm where he was born is on what's called a minimum maintenance road. And you're warned, not to go down it unless you've got good tires and stuff. So, I mean, unlike, most vice presidents or presidents, he has not been accorded his due. And yet the farm is well maintained. We were in an upstairs room there where they've got some of the old historical artifacts, Time magazine covers, pictures of Roosevelt and Wallace campaigning together, a host of other things. And we did have a long conversation there. I interviewed him, in the upstairs room at Wallace's farm, about the New Deal and about, kind of maintaining this ambitious vision. Sanders really did, especially in his 2020 campaign, sought to kind of reanimate the economic Bill of Rights, this visionary proposal that Roosevelt made at the last stages of his presidency and that Wallace really tried to bring into our politics. And then Sanders also tried to talk about a different foreign policy and the idea that, America should be less committed to a huge Pentagon militarism, and more committed to diplomacy and cooperation. And so I wouldn't suggest that Sanders is, an embodiment of Wallace. He's not. He's different, in many, many different ways. But it is a continuation of this struggle for the soul of the party. And I could have concluded the book there, but I wanted to look more deeply at what the Sanders campaign meant going forward and what all of these campaigns meant going forward. And so I went to Detroit around the same time with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was there campaigning for some candidates in the Michigan primary. And as it happened, we sat down and I did an interview not many blocks, really, from where Wallace had given his remarkable speech in 1943, calling out Americanized fascism and calling out racism. There we talked about the incredible struggles to change a party, to change a country, and the movement-based politics, the fact that it doesn't happen in short order, that it often takes a long time, and also about the possibility that this time, then we, of course, didn't have coronavirus developing in the way it is or the economic crisis that we now see. But even then, back in the summer of 2019, about the challenges of this time with technology and automation and so many other issues and the need for big ideas, the need for visionary approaches. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we're standing in the parking lot. It was around midnight. We were in Dearborn, just on the edge of Detroit. And she was talking about how important it was to have a huge vision of what the Democratic Party could be. And she talked about Roosevelt and that period. And the last thing she said to me was, "I want to be that party again."
I want to be that party again. John Nichols, his new book is The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. It's being published this week by Verso. John, thanks for this book, and thanks for talking with us today.
I appreciate it, John. Thank you so much for having me.
Now it's time for the Children's Hour. Stories about Ivanka, Jared, Don Jr., and little Eric. Boy, those kids are in trouble this week. For that, we turn to our chief Jared correspondent, Amy Willens. Of course, she's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. She was Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker, and she's best known for her work on Haiti, and she was just awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship for next year. Amy, welcome back, and congratulations on the Guggenheim.
Thanks so much, John. Yes, I'm really pleased about that.
Well, let's start today with Jared. We've been reading some new news about Project Air Bridge. That's his White House coronavirus project. First, remind us, what is Project Air Bridge? It's big.
It's a huge $1 billion taxpayer-funded program to bring PPE into the United States, largely from China, through private contractors. And Jared is running it.
Private contractors both to purchase the stuff and to bring it in. What is the latest news about the success of Project AirBridge?
We don't really know, because the Trump administration has apparently issued orders to FEMA, which is part of the Trump administration in a sense, not to reveal where these materials are going. So they're brought into the country at taxpayer expense. They go somewhere, but we're not entitled to know that. The New York Times now has a Freedom of Information Act going to try and find out where the federal government is distributing these supplies. The FEMA said, we can't tell you that. And they also added, in an aside, we would normally tell you that, but we can't tell you that. So for all we know, they're going to Republican voting states and swing states where, you know, perhaps a few N95 masks might just turn the vote to Trump in November, in spite of the fact that he would like to liberate all those states.
Well, in other Jared news, he's been sort of cheerful about Trump's efforts at beating the virus. He appeared on Fox TV News the same day that the American death toll from the virus topped the American death toll in Vietnam. And what was his approach that day?
Well, John, first, you, who are an expert in that era of American history, can perhaps tell us how long it took the United States to accrue 60,000 deaths in Vietnam. How long did it take, John?
Well, it depends when you start, but you could say from 1963 to 1975, 12 years, 13 years, something like that.
So 60,000 in 13 years, and here in 3 months, 60,000. So that's what was happening when Jared said on Fox News, you know, this is a great success. We've had a great success in the United States, and I think we're gonna be really rocking. As my listeners may know, that is not me, but a quote. I think we're gonna be really rocking again by July. Meanwhile, internally, the Trump administration privately projects a steady rise in the next week in deaths because of opening up the economy in various states, which the Trump administration has been pushing. So they expect by June 1st, there will be 3,000 deaths per day, 200,000 new cases per day. They know that internally at the White House. And yet Jared is going out, who works in the White House, by the way, and saying that we'll be really rocking again by July. Well, maybe by really rocking, he's talking about having the most deaths in the world.
Well, enough about Jared. What's Ivanka been up to lately? She was in the news about the what seemed to be a perfectly modest idea of going to a Passover Seder with Jared's parents.
She's such a good Jewish girl. she took a private plane with her children to some airport, I don't know where, to go to a shut-down Trump facility in
Bedminster.
Bedminster. I knew it sounded like a British official building. Bedminster, New Jersey. And she went for a Seder, leaving her majestic Kalorama mansion and not doing what the rest of the Jewish community in the United States did and in Israel and in France, which was have a Zoom Seder because they didn't want to congregate and thereby infect all the elders in the family. They apparently had a Seder together, or anyway, that was her excuse for moving her family, as far as I understand it, to Bedminster.
They said they were not violating the stay-at-home orders in part because this was a private plane. Do you know anything more about this? Is this Air Force One or what is it?
Maybe they chartered a plane. Maybe they own a plane. Maybe it's a Jared family plane. I don't know what this plane, private plane is that they took. I wonder if it was Air Force One and they charged the taxpayer. So that means that Jared went to a Seder with his family and who knows who else, and childcare people, who knows? staff, perhaps from the Bedminster facility. We cannot know. And then he went back to Washington to tell us how we're going to be really rocking in July. Was he wearing a mask? I doubt it, because nobody in the White House wears a mask except for one person we saw in a photo who's anonymous. They all stand around next to each other. So he could easily have infected everybody in the White House.
Let's talk about the masks business. The president has made it clear that he's not going to wear a mask. And as you say, there's lots of photographs of staffers meeting and they're not wearing masks. But there are some members of the president's family who are wearing masks. Tell us about them.
Oh, Ivanka and Arabella, her daughter, posted this really cute photograph. I have a very soft spot for Arabella.
Notice.
She's saying happy birthday in Chinese. I love that girl. And also, apparently, she's an adept homemaker, Arabella, at a young age, because she sewed her mommy a mask and her mommy sewed hers one. And they appear in an Instagram photo together. Really cute, except Arabella's isn't as good as Ivanka's. Ivanka made the better mask. But of course, she runs a garment industry. She ran a garment industry company, so she should know how to make a face mask. So that's what they've been doing at home, and they posted their little picture wearing it. But they can wear masks, if I may stoop to some analysis here, because they're women. Women can wear masks, but real men who sit behind, what is the name of his desk again, John? I can never remember it. I have a psychological problem.
Enterprise or Encounter or something
Reformer,
like that?
Former Reconstructor, really big man desk. He sits behind that desk, and he can't wear a mask because that would be too embarrassing, you know. And Pence went to the hospital. Which hospital in New York? Was it Sloan Kettering? He went into the COVID area and he didn't wear a mask, and he was surrounded by doctors wearing a mask. And when he was asked why he didn't wear a mask, he said, because he wanted to look them in the eyes. He has that same problem of not knowing where the mask goes. He thinks the mask like it's Halloween? No. But I think it's really interesting to think about the Trump White House and the mask and who's wearing one and who isn't. Because if the president doesn't wear a mask, you know how people around presidents are. If he doesn't wear a mask, all the men there are going to think they shouldn't wear masks. And then if I were the wife and mother of the children of one of those men who was in the Oval Office standing around with Trump and Pence unmasked, I wouldn't let them back in my house.
Unmasked takes a kind of a different meaning in this context than what we usually talk about, unmasking the White House. I should add here that Ivanka is not just posting a cute picture of herself and her daughter. She is recommending to her millions of Instagram followers, everybody should wear a mask. Here's a fun project for you and your kids to take up at home. We did it. You should do it, too.
Right. Absolutely. And who do you think the people are who are among her 1 million followers? What do you think the percentage is of he-men who sit behind the Endeavor reconstitution desk? The percentage is very low. Donald Trump might be her only male follower. But anyway, she's recommending this to moms and young moms, stay-at-home people, to wear their masks. And it's good. She's good. I like her for that. You should be recommending it. There's a little bit of discord in the Trump family on this.
And speaking of discord, there's one other Trump woman who has also advocated wearing masks by appearing in a mask online. And who is that?
That's Melania. And I think that's great, too. She was right to do that. And there's always discord there. Whatever he does, she doesn't do. Whatever he doesn't do, she does. But I also have been known to say about the mask that the mask is a great thing for the women of Beverly Hills and people like Melania, because right now it's harder to go to your cosmetic surgeon to get your injections and to have your little lifts. So if you wear a mask over, you know, two-thirds of your face, you're hiding 2 months of damage. And so I can see why Melania is wearing it until she can get someone to come to the White House to do her injections for her. Not that she has injections.
Okay, so we've talked about Jared. We've talked about Ivanka and Melania and Arabella. What about Eric? What about little Eric, as we call him? What's he been up to?
Teeny little Eric, at the beginning of the administration, was put in charge of the Trump winery. And Trump sort of divested himself of it. Although, as most of the news reports point out, the Trump organization still owns the land that Trump Winery is on, but Eric owns Trump Winery and is in charge of it. And so he put up a Twitter post saying, you know, if you're running out of quarantine wine, come get it at the Trump Winery. We have great wines, blah, 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 blah. Which, you know, taking advantage of all the death and destruction that's happening and people being at home wanting to drink, he's trying to profit from that.
He's helping.
But one of the interesting things about this, of course, is that they own a winery and Eric's running it. And one kind of immigrant was allowed into the country when Trump began to crack down on all immigration to the United States. And that immigrant is an agricultural worker. And those are the people who work on the Trump winery. So Trump's immigration policy favors the workers on his own plantations. But there was in the Twitter comments after Eric was trying to sell his quarantine wine, there was a reply that I would like to read in full. Love this wine, bold, but with nice top notes, redolent of incest, treason, charity fraud, crushed Adderall, and dementia. I did not write that reply, but it's a good one.
Last but not least, you found for us a story about the wives and girlfriends of Don Jr. and Eric Trump.
Yes, Trump's campaign, his campaign fund for 2020, is, I would have to say secretly, although now that I'm telling you this, folks, it's not so secret and it's been reported on, but attemptedly in secret, paying Lara Trump, that's Eric's wife, and Don's girlfriend, Kimberly Guilfoyle, $180,000 a year through the campaign manager's private company, so that avoiding the possible legal consequences of just directly siphoning it out of the campaign funds, they move the campaign funds into Parscale, I forget his first name, into Parscale's he's the campaign manager and he has a private company. And then it goes out $18,000 a month to each of these women for being like campaign spokespeople around the country, et cetera, or for doing nothing or for tweeting and being attractive. I don't really know what it's for. I don't know what their specific role in the campaign is, but they are making $180,000 each a year, which shows that there is some benefit to going out with one of the Trumps.
Amy Willens, our Chief Jared Correspondent, with this week's episode of The Children's Hour. Amy, thanks so much for telling us all about it today.
You are so welcome.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Our audio engineer is William Broughton. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Frank Reynolds is our executive producer. Annie Shields is The Nation's engagement editor. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. For more principled, progressive journalism from The Nation, you can subscribe online to our print and digital magazine at thenation.com/podcast subscribe with this special discount for Start Making Sense listeners. You can get digital access to all our articles for less than $1.50 a month, or you can have our print magazine delivered to you for just 60 cents an issue. That's at thenation.com/podcast subscribe, one word. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. You can subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Pocket Casts. I'm John Wiener. Tune in to Start Making Sense next week for more political talk without the boring parts.